Right, the poem Survivor, it was based on the words chair, lime, ale, feather, garlic. And it was really strange. I'd been looking at this picture by Pearl Gauguin of Anna the Japanese, and I knew that she sat in a limewood chair in the picture. I knew I wanted to write a poem about it, and then the five words, lime and chair, were two of the words. So there you go. So it's Survivor. It's loosely based on their relationship. I've changed a few things. Towards the quays, he found her, golden-skinned in the rain, begging for Sue. An impudent 13, she ran her fingers over his trousers and went back to his studio to pose nude in the limewood chair he'd carved with parrot's heads and crescent moons and palm leaf fans. A ginger rough monkey scratched its ribs at her feet. He took her out of Paris, ignoring her pout, to the northwest, painted her with a fox laying its paws on her breasts in a feathery meadow of scented grasses and wild garlic. But drinking Breton ale in the wrong quarter, he had his ankle broken in a fight with sailors. Anna fled, pausing to ransack his apartment before she boarded a train for the south, dressed in ribbons and flounces. Years later, she is photographed, her darkened face wearing the marks of her immigrant lifetime, long after he has died, with a girl of the islands brooding by his bed. They had met, crossed, parted, putting on and taking off the clothes of Europe, each dreaming of their own paradise. She still sits in the limewood chair, but there is no monkey anymore. Thank you. I'll read the other shortlisted poem, which is quite different. I think that's the marvellous thing about the competition, it drives you into different things. This is called The Hair Clinic, At the Hair Clinic. This one sits on your head like a skunk, a mop of hair with a jazzy stripe of orange down the centre. At the other end of the range, there's a middle rank executive in naturalistic grey. This is one of our most popular styles, says the salesperson, officially the trichological consultant. He likes to be on first-name terms to put the clients at their ease. I'm alopecia, you say brightly. They seem so alive, the weaves, as if they will leap from their pegs and scurry on the floor, beetle quick, fringes of thrashing cilia escaping the scalp, scabbed and tufted, they might disguise. But yours is as beautiful as a full moon, uncrated, a slight bony ridge creating shadow, a death's head hint that some people find disquieting. You step out through the logo printed doors, you wear the skunk. And I'll read a few other poems. Just tell me when to stop.
Absolutely, you're all keep going, you're good.
This is a poem called Street Vendor Southwest China. It's based on a photo that my wife Elaine Sweeney, who died, but she was, her family was from Cork actually, so it's appropriate that I read it tonight. And it's a photo of a vendor in Chengdu in China. A vendor has buried her face in her lap, rocked back, hips on heels, arms folded across her knees, so that her silhouette seems headless, compressed to a cube of fatigue. Loaded each end with baskets, the pole completes the geometry of a cell, its shadow on her neck. A burden set down is still a burden. But these are pretty wares, with red and green and yellow trimmings, with woven lids like temple roofs and flared openings. Perhaps we're wrong to read the posture as despair. It's noon, it's hot, so she creates her own shade, fits herself to the most economical shape a human skeleton allows. Later, she'll set off on her circuit of the town, an independent businesswoman, the street her market. We'll never know how she'd rate our pity, and whether she would pity us for the burdens that we carry in our heads. And it's a poem called The Mushroom Pickers. It was an incident in the war in Chechnya in 2010. There were a group of mushroom pickers who were mostly teenagers, and they were mistaken for rebels, and they were attacked and killed by troops. And yeah, it just seemed such a waste of life. The Mushroom Pickers. Rebel patrol, or merely foragers, calling their chat to one another in the tall spaces, mirror walking the line between fun and death. They wander, blunder, through a zone of trees, an unidentified group with unidentified intent, their path as random as the fungus clumps they hunt, snaking their way into slaughter, bending to pluck, straightening into soft targets. And look, a white giant, stalk as thick as two thumbs, there in the roots. Drawn by musty treasure, they cross the line. They are no longer the children of the forest. Bullets thump into their chests. Their damp innards explode like puffballs in a cloud of spores. And this is a poem called The Iron Necklace. It was based on something I heard during the radio programme, Neil McGregor's radio programme about Germany. And Prussian, during the Napoleonic Wars, Prussian women, upper class women, wore iron, they gave their jewels for the war effort, and they wore iron necklaces to show their support for their people, their country. The Iron Necklace. It weighs a little heavier on the breast, with its own sober sheen. Nine dark allegories are rimmed in glinting silver, chill against the skin. You could say this is a slight sacrifice for Prussian dames in the court safety, who'll never need these medallions to stop a musket ball. They move more stately, though, fettered by patriotism, willingly bearing the yoke. It's a fine thing to give gold for iron, showing solidarity with laundry women, cooks, soldiers' wives, even barracks' whores. But after the battles ended and peace returned, with diamonds, rubies, pearls, they naturally forgot that war had hung heavy round other necks too. I've written some poems about Spanish paintings. I lived in Spain. This is a painting called, lived in Spain a long time ago, so my accent's not so good anymore, Dos Mujeres en la Playa by Marco Mayo. And it's two women on a beach, one with no clothes on, another one very wrapped up, muffled, and it just seemed to ask for a story to go with it. One liked to sleep on the left side of the bed, and one on the right. One muffled herself like a Berber bride, and one loved to drink the light through her skin. One unnerved you with her silences, one with her confidences. I was the lover of both. One would lie gleaming on top of me like a lion at its prey, and the other lifted no more than a hem in the night to let me in. Twins, without even the difference of a mould. Who could swear which was the Sphinx in the darkness and which was running bare? Whatever games they played, slipping in and out of each other's identity, ended with the boating accident a mile off the beach. Strong currents, black rocks, stripped and battered the one corpse that came to shore, so that I called both their names, cradling her head. The sea did not distinguish. Like them, it concealed and hid. And the last one, and it is called The Arch in Its Shadow. Which was suggested by a painting by Mike Eden, a Dorset painter. The Arch in Its Shadow. When I passed through the arch, I did not see the shadow. I was looking so hard into the light. Someone was hidden in the side darkness, plucking my sleeve and asking for pity, where the stone stank of drunkard's piss. The entered city was in celebration, with 10-story flags on the buildings and marching bands in quartered uniforms. A woman waited in a clearing in the crowds and said, as if she made a proclamation, "Darling, this is our Independence Day." I was speaking that night to the wedding guests, full of confidence of successful passage, thinking again of the archtop statuary, the winged horses of joy and hope. And suddenly, half of my vision was darkened, and I could not remember my bride's name. Then I ran to the city rim and slept out on the paved threshold of the hills, where the arch and its shadow were one.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you.